Nikki, thanks for your time today.
It's a pleasure.
Last week you were, as I was, with Safe Work Australia, a seminar on the national strategy.
Yeah.
One of the speakers said at the time that safety still had a low profile in Australia. Given that you've had a television series called Stress Busters that, you know, was on national television, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your thoughts on whether safety does have a low profile, and also what benefit it had to actually, well, was there any exposure? You know, did the television show help safety in general?
Well, I guess I'd like to take those two issues slightly separately. So the first question is, what's the profile of health and safety, Kevin?
Sorry.
Health and safety in Australia. And I think that my time overseas, I had 5 years overseas at the beginning of the 2000, and I think that that really made me realise that the profile of occupational health and safety in Australia is quite high. When I say quite high, I mean the way we deal with it, we deal with it in quite a strategic level. So in my work, particularly when I was doing consultancy work, I was really dealing at CEO level, at operation manager level, at board level. And it was often dealt with as a strategic issue. When I went to England, it was still a middle management compliance issue. So I think that really in the 80s and the 90s, Australia made a shift and started to see that health and safety was related to the overall business goals, and that there could be there could be some wins, but there could also be losses through reputation risks. So I think actually Australia's done quite well, and Australia is perceived in that way. But if we then come back and look domestically and say how do I think things are going, I still feel with particularly with CEOs, they're either on or off. You know, they've either got it and they see that they that it's an important way of engaging with their workforce, and it's an important opportunity to demonstrate that they do care about the workforce, and not just in an abstract way, in an absolutely fundamentally important way. And then you have other managers that don't give a shit, basically, and essentially, I think risk management just sort of say what can we get away with. So I think that the thing that came up to me when we were in that workshop last week was looking back at the last 10 years. I mean, we're developing a new strategy now for Australia. That's what Safe Work Australia is doing, and that will be another 10-year strategy. The question for me was, let's look back over the last 10 years and what have we achieved. And I couldn't help but think, gosh, there's a few issues here that are going to be in the new strategy, and I don't know that we really got anywhere in the old strategy. For example, has safe design moved ahead that much in 10 years? I think not. I think that when we look at the targets that were set, we haven't achieved what we had hoped to achieve or anywhere near it. So I think there's some important questions about if that's what we wanted to do and we didn't get there. I think it's quite interesting to say why, and before we hurtle off with another one, to say what is the capacity that we've built, where is it that we can get leverage, and to really be very realistic about that.
I think that I was disappointed with the seminar in that I wanted more analysis of the last 10 years to so that I knew what not to deal with or the areas of focus for the next 10. And I think, and I've said this elsewhere, that I think we didn't know what, any of the participants didn't know what we were in for. And so we had to think on the hop, very short notice about all this. I think probably some more preparatory work so that we had more of a workshop would have been better. But I do think that the fact that the regulator is out talking, and national, and also the caliber of people that they were able to draw upon was quite phenomenal. And I came away from there looking around the audience and thinking, well, there's hope of some real improvements because of the type of people that were there. So
yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that, and they, you know, had 11 workshops, so it was a really terrific effort at consultation. But I think that one of the things I've become very interested in is futures methodologies. And we ran a futures initiative at the Institute for Safety, Compensation and Recovery Research last year, working with a futurist, Sahail Eniatula, who's one of the four best in the world. And one of the principles that you learn in futures methodologies, it's called timing the future. is that it is productive to look back at history, because you see how far you have or have not come over a period. So look back 10 years and then that helps you look forward 10 years. So I think it's an important thing to contextualise. But I think that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that, in my experience, the way health and safety operates in Australia is by and large at a pretty interesting strategic level. Many organisations are doing that. You know, I think some of the public sector organisations could do that more, because I think it's the private sector that have run with that. But that's changing. I went to a fantastic seminar the other day that the Department of Justice were running, where all the senior managers turned up to hear me talking about stress and putting that in the context of them developing their new strategy. So
I asked about profile. I mean, the pulling power you have, Nikki. I mean, you said to me last week that you spoke, you're a keynote speaker at a conference, a safety conference. Was it last year or earlier this year? And you ended up with a lot of approaches as a result of that for keynotes elsewhere. Has it surprised you that you're in demand?
Gosh, that's a funny question. I mean, what happened there was really interesting, because I was invited to give the keynote at the Safety in Action conference, and I based it on the Futures work that we did last year. And the Futures work delivered some really interesting ideas, and I guess two big ideas were that in the future, occupational health and safety is probably going to have to be less isolated and work more in partnership with other sectors, because we're going to be dealing with illness much more than injury, and that that's more complex and requires a greater approach. I think also another issue that came up in the Futures work that we did was that if you want to think about the future, you have to go to deeply held beliefs. And the two deeply held beliefs that we're not really dealing with explicitly, which I found in a fantastic Dutch paper, which did a massive literature review on this. And essentially they said people either believe in accident-prone individuals, in other words, somebody's it's a safety behaviour problem, or they believe in healthy and safe and unhealthy and unsafe environments. And then that was picked up by the law faculty, or there was some synergy with some work that the University of Sydney Law Faculty was doing, which showed that the regulators really believed in the environmental approach and that many managers still believed in the individual behaviour approach. So we're not going to get anywhere until we make that a bit more explicit, until we deal with that. So they're the things I was talking about. Anyway, so I thought I'd done my talk. I had all my slides ready on a Friday night, as you know, they'd gone off to the person to do the slides. I had house guests on Saturday and Sunday. The conference was coming up, and on Saturday morning I just knew I didn't have it. I just knew what I wanted to say wasn't right. And so I had this ghastly weekend trying to push my house guests away so I could think about this more. And on Sunday night had to sit up late into the night and rethought it all, and rethought, what am I really trying to say? And then I presented it. And I think it was worth doing that extra point, because I think I raised some issues that people could relate to that weren't being made explicit, and I think that's what people have run with.
But I think also that
do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. You did. My experience with conferences is that they're in Australia, they're dreadfully bland, because quite often they're saying things we already know. The thing that made your keynote stand out at the Safety in Action conference was that you challenged. So you didn't stroke the audience. It was, this is what you guys need to be thinking about. That made it much more than normal. So it was a standout, and I think that's probably why you're in demand. Ask the questions, you pose the questions. Also, that you've got a network of information that you're able to pull in and apply obliquely in some other way, in a creative way. So I think that's true. One thing I wanted to do, talking about your network of research and your experience in that, is the issue of practical research. We have a lot of people in Australia calling for more research into health and safety, more research grants, all sorts of things. Now, predominantly they're researchers who are calling for that, but one of the things that I've always been critical of is research for research's sake, and particularly in health and safety, seems to be you've got to have a practical endpoint for any research that you do in health and safety. I wonder what your thoughts are in terms of that.
Oh, look, absolutely, absolutely. And that's really what I'm on about right now. So ISCA, which is the Institute for Safety, Compensation and Recovery Research, which I'll say ISCA now.
ISCA.
And ISCA was set up because I think the regulators, so it's WorkSafe and the Transport Accident Commission, had the same sense. You know, I think that they felt that they were investing in research. I think that they're committed to having an evidence base to support what they do. But they just felt they weren't getting the research questions that they wanted addressed. It was hard to get the research done that they wanted. And then it was hard to get outputs that they could use. So they really wanted to find a way of having research done that was relevant and actionable. So that's the sort of catch cry that we use. And that's really how ISCA came about. And it's a partnership with Monash. And Monash, who puts a lot of resources into it, so it's a real partnership. Monash are doing it because I think that they sense, as many universities do, that universities need to become more closely linked to community. So we have this wonderful opportunity. You know, we have resources, we have the support of two regulators, we operate out of a university, and our whole mission is to do research that is relevant and actionable. So we're absolutely of that mindset. And again, when we had the Futures Initiative last year, we asked the stakeholders that were there to say, what are the research questions that you think we need to be done? That was at the end of going forward, you know, if this is what 2035 looks like. And then we analysed it for the type of research they wanted done. And about half of the votes for the research questions were for interventional research. So the research needs that came out of that were interventional research. What works and what doesn't work? Just, you know, action research.
Right.
Develop something, do it, test it. And also new performance indicators. There's this huge demand for indicators other than the outcome indicators of claims and lost time injuries and so on. So there are a couple of the things that we will be working on in our... We've just launched our five-year research strategy. That Minister launched that a couple of weeks ago. And as far as OHS and return to work is concerned, we'll be working on new performance indicators, including a lead OHS indicator. We'll be working on a massive evidence review with the Institute of Work and Health to update their seven principles work that they did. And we'll be also looking at this very complicated question of what is the best mix in terms of enforcement. So what is the best use of the resource that you have in a regulator, and how, what's the best mix of carrots and sticks and so on?
Well, one of the things that I hear often from Australian OHS academics is that you know, they have the capacity to do the research, but they don't have the funding to do that. It seems odd to me that that ISCA has come from really outside the established tertiary structure. Is that somebody decided that, well, to really move forward, we have to go beyond, or go around the back, or just around the houses, my mother used to say, to actually get something new, to get that new approach. That implies that the tertiary institutions in Australia didn't have the capacity to do that. And I just wondered also that some of those tertiary institutions are closing OHS studies and courses. Just wondering if the two are linked, is that, you know, the universities aren't keeping up with modern approaches to health and safety research, and that the dropping of the courses and the student numbers is perhaps a reflection of that.
Well, I think it is. And certainly in the conversations that I've had with policymakers since I took up this job, you know, coming up for 2 years ago, would confirm that. And I think that I think on the other hand, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I think that what Monash proposed when it put in its tender, because this was put out to tender, is a very interesting model, because what's happened in the model of ISCA is we operate out of Monash. We operate out of a well-established, traditional kind of university, but that the authority of the Vice-Chancellor has been delegated to our board, and our board comprises the regulators and the university. And what that really means is that we can innovate within the university system. And I guess what I've learnt over the past 2 years, and I also ran a centre not unlike this before this one, the Centre for Military and Veterans Health, so that's relevant as well, is what you have to go for is real dialogue between the researchers and the policymakers. It isn't a question of policymakers saying, we've got the money, this is what we want done, and then contracting research. It's having conversations where the policymakers bring their knowledge to the table and the researchers bring their longer-term knowledge and their knowledge of what's on the horizon. So I think it's a fascinating time.
Mm. One of the things that you've spoken at conferences in the past, I think particularly at ComCare, as you brought to the attention of some people that had never heard of this before, the work of Dame Carol Black in England.
Yep.
Now, that got a lot of attention when she released her final report. It was quite challenging. I don't know if her recommendations have really been picked up in the way that she would have liked, both in England but more generally. You're more familiar with Carol Black's work than many others. How have you seen the legacy of Carol Black's report?
I think that report was so outstanding and so different, and it was such a step change. You know, it really allowed us to think about things in a different way, and that is her legacy. So if nothing else happens, it's such an important legacy. And I think the way she said, let's broaden the relationship. This isn't just a relationship about what's going on in workplaces. This is also about the interface between workplaces and the community, including with regulators. And so I think that that's the way of the future, that she has done something very important, and thinking around that continues on in other ways. In terms of also the government's response to her report, I think is one of the best reports that I've ever read, including the staggeringly fabulous evaluation framework they designed at the end, when they said virtually, gosh, we don't have any data that we can use to measure this. We'll have to invent some new measures and set about doing that. And I suspect, you know, not much of that has happened. So I think probably it's fair to say that it hasn't been implemented yet as conceptualised, but I think that some interesting experiments are occurring in terms of trying to set up services that might support workplaces differently. But again, I think it was a very important report.
Yeah, I think from an Antipodean perspective, which could be absolutely wrong, we reached a high with Carol Black's report. And then only a matter of years later, we ended up with, you know, a plummet through the GFC impacts in England to a report that we got. I think it was, you know, Common Sense, Common Safety, the report that came out earlier this year, late last year, that the Prime Minister David Cameron has taken up. That they almost seem poles apart over such a short period of time. It sort of shows that no matter the good intentions of OHS, is that the political realities will always impose and place limitations.
Well, I was just going to say, a global financial crisis and a change of government will do that to you, won't it? But the other thing that I found interesting about the Cameron government is that they produced a public health white paper, which I thought was breathtakingly visionary. And what they did in that was to say, we have good relationships with industry, therefore we should use those relationships to improve public health. So I think that was, you know, that was a very progressive agenda, and it gave me heart. So I think one of the other issues that's quite interesting is things are going to change. It's clear that the interface between workplaces and community on health is going to open up a bit, I think. That's becoming very obvious. And to me, the question is occupational health and safety going to be a part of that or not? Is occupational health and safety going to continue to define its role in a very narrow way where it says what we do is manage the bit of all of this that's about workplace risk factors. Now, that's a legitimate viewpoint, but if the agenda broadens, where does that leave occupational health and safety? So I think it's a dilemma and an issue for us as OHS practitioners that we should be thinking about and should be a bit more vocal about. And if we want to hold on to our place in the sun, we might have to do a bit more than we are doing.
Look, I think that's right, but the legislation itself seems to have changed to an extent and broadened the application to an extent that the OHS profession hasn't kept up with. Is that, you know, the new laws will deal with workers and people who come onto the premises far more overtly than it has in the past. So I think probably we've got to a point where we are, as the Act is called, work health and safety. It's not occupational. There's no factory fence lines now in either application or thought. But I think a lot of the debate is the occupational health and safety profession struggling with saying, well, geez, I've got to deal with machine guarding and the mental health issues of the person operating the machine. How do I do that? And I think many professionals are really struggling with that. They haven't been given the skills over the last 20, 30 years, really, to cope with that.
I think you're quite right. And I wrote a chapter in a book.
I'll give it a plug.
It was a book on ethics, and I was asked to write from the employer perspective. So what did employers think about ethics in occupational health and safety? And I said, well, rather than answering that question, why don't I answer the question, what do employers think of occupational health and safety? And I used an analysis of corporate social responsibility. So I said, let's analyse corporate social responsibility. So I sat in the British Library and used all of their media databases. So I looked at how it was discussed in the media and looked at some of the key websites. And I said that really health is big in corporate social responsibility. But when you look at how people talk about occupational health and safety in that bigger picture, it's really very narrowly defined. So it's exactly the point that you're making. And I was interested to meet with one of the productivity commissioners that had done some benchmarking of the OHS authorities around Australia. And he said, I thought this was fascinating. In his report, it's touched on quite gently, but what he said kind of privately was that I was really surprised the authorities weren't gearing up more for psychosocial issues and mental health issues, because it's clearly the name of the game in the future. And it is quite a hard transition to make. It is not easy. So I think I agree with you that that we in the profession, the leaders in the profession, need to decide what space we want to be in, and then we need to lift ourselves up by our bootstraps, I think.
But I think also some of our profession has been dictated or made compatible with the government structures. So you have a Department of Health, you have a Department of Workplace, you have a Department of Industrial Relations. At the moment, there's lots of talk within government of whole-of-government approaches, but it seems to me that occupational health and safety has to have a whole-of-government approach, or even some structural change in government departments, so that the strategies actually are talking in the same way as the legislation, in the same way as the expectations of business.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that's the way that we see that it will go, or hope that it will go. I guess one thing in my mind, though, is that professional bodies don't have to wait for that to happen to start forming alliances with other professional bodies. I mean, I think the work that AFOM's done on its policy in recent months is a good example of taking a lead on something and coming out and speaking up.
Yeah. Well, look, I do regularly have a look at a lot of the work that Europe's doing. They've got a lot of interesting associations for that. Wanted to talk quickly, though, about mental health, as it is the biggest challenge to health and safety. One of the things that always frustrates me is that I don't think that mental health in the workplace gets the attention it does. Quite often it's segmented into bullying, stress, fatigue. We don't have a the whole of concept approach to mental health. One of the other ones is depression. Quite often depression gets a lot of attention, and yet it's only one part of the package. If you could give me a bit of an idea of what you talk about. I think in ComCare conference you talked about psychosocial, biological, blah, blah, blah. I think it was a long term. I couldn't write it all down. But also I wanted to talk to you about the issue of resilience, as that comes up a lot. And it's a concept I'm not comfortable with as an OHS professional. So I wonder if you could...
Yeah. Well, you mentioned before Stress Buster, and I think that really describes well my starting point. And my starting point is that it does frustrate me as I see the mental health agenda unfolding, and it seems to be all about change at an individual level. It all seems to be about assisting people to cope better, you know, to make people more resilient, without acknowledging properly the mounting substantial evidence base that we have, that the way work is organised and the way people are managed contribute significantly to pressure to people and the ability of an organisation to help somebody. So I think the first thing is we really do have to get that on the agenda more than it has been so in the past. And I think that I would feel happier about what happened next if I saw some greater effort in that direction. Some people are doing it, but not an awful lot. And I think that there's enough evidence to show that we do have effective strategies for that. But having said that, I fully agree that what we want are balanced strategies. So what we want, and the evidence shows that this is true. I mean, Tony LaMontagne did a brilliant lit review which shows that the best approach is to have interventions which tackle organisational change as well as individual change or efforts to support individuals.
It was terrific. And that came through, though, the Department of Health. And yet it was a substantial issue in terms of workplace.
Yes.
But sadly, it didn't get the traction it needed because it wasn't given the WorkSafe treatment. It was the health treatment. Many of the profession just looked to WorkSafe or ComCare and nowhere else. And yet that information was just so important.
Well, actually, I mean, it's not entirely true because WorkSafe have done interventions which are similar to the UK stress management standards because they're the model, and then the EU primer framework continues on with that. But it certainly hasn't taken off and it hasn't been given the emphasis. What we're now seeing is around the country, workplaces just picking up this idea of resilience and running with it. So there probably wouldn't be a large corporate now that doesn't have a website that tackles mental health. But if you look on those websites, there'll be a reference to management and a reference to job design, but it isn't the same emphasis at all. So I just think that's plain wrong. I mean, it's plain wrong because it's not fair, and it's plain wrong because it's not consistent with the evidence. If you want to get the best results, you should be looking at balancing this and having both sides.
Well, is the low take-up of mental health interventions for companies, though, could that be because to undertake true intervention, to actually control the hazard, the company would have to re-examine its whole way of business, because it may be that the traditional structure of the business is generating negative mental health conditions in its workforce. Maybe by analysing it, it's too threatening. So therefore, if we can put the resilience on the individual, we then don't need to actually have a look at our toxic structure.
Well, I think I agree with you. You know, I think it is very, and actually say that in a more empathetic way than you say it, because I think first of all, well, I'm thinking of the managers here, because I think that this topic really speaks to the heart of your management style.
Mm, yes.
And it is quite threatening, and I feel that as a manager. You know, I feel when things go wrong and I know that I can see somebody's under pressure or somebody leaves, you know, saying that there's too much pressure here, you do feel it. It is quite a difficult thing to deal with as a manager. So I think that is a reason, and I think that management style and managers, as you would probably know in the UK, this has emerged as a major part of the response, and I think that's very important. And that's not even getting to the design of work, which is harder even still in terms of the impact on the business. But I think that we have to go there, and I think in the end the evidence is it'll deliver results. If we were measuring the impact of what we do in terms of presenteeism, in terms of productivity, in terms of quality, instead of the short-term, very limited measures that we tend to use, once we start to use these broader measures, I think people will see the results, and hopefully that will help.
Mm. All right. Well, we might leave it there. We've been talking for about half an hour. Thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you.